a minute. Okay. Hey, Eric, can you see my screen? Thank you. So I want to bring us all up to date on this idea of this awkwardly named non-celiac gluten sensitivity. Isn't that odd? A condition named for what it's not, right? A non-urinary tract infection. A non-rosacea skin rash. It really doesn't tell you much about what's going on, but that's what this is called. It's a non-celiac gluten sensitivity. So let's talk about celiac disease just for a moment. So celiac disease, of course, is inflammation of the small bowel triggered by exposure, people say, to gluten, but it's mostly the gliadin within gluten and perhaps some degree the glutenin. Remember that gluten is a combination of the gliadin globular protein and the string-like glutenin stretchy proteins. That's the stuff that gives dough its viscoelasticity, the dough stretchiness. So people who have the HLA-DQ8 or HLA-DQ2 genes, which is 40% of the population, by the way, some small percentage of those people, in total about 1 to 1.5% of the population, develop celiac disease or its relatives. And when someone undergoes a biopsy, you'll see that the villi, those are the hair-like projections that increase the absorptive surface area of the small bowel, are eroded or are knocked off. And you see on the right side, there's loss of villi and something called crypt hyperplasia. And all that means is the valleys are much longer and you really can't make it on these pictures. But those kind of purple dots, those are all inflammatory lymphocytes. So there's inflammation. There's a loss of absorptive potential and loss of villi and this so-called crypt hyperplasia. And of course, it's very painful and lots of symptoms like diarrhea, abdominal pain, if there's overt intestinal involvement. So about 1 to 1.5% of the population has this, even though 40% have the HLA-DQ markers that put people at risk. So there's something else that tends to bring it out in people who have those HLA-DQ genes. There's been a fourfold increase in incidence of celiac disease, probably around the 70s and 80s. And the best evidence tells us it was because of a change in the gliadin gene and gliadin structure induced by agribusiness. In other words, all the manipulations made by agribusiness and agricultural geneticists introduced changes. They weren't purposeful changes in gliadin. They were made for such things as increased yield per acre, increased resistance to pest, shorter stature, right? High-yield semi-dwarf wheat, larger seeds, larger seed head, resist. So these were agricultural concerns, increased wheat germ agglutinin and phytate content for resistance to pests. So the wheat plant was changed for those reasons, but no thought given to its appropriateness, this new changed form of wheat for humans. And one of the unintended effects was a change in the gliadin protein structure that has been backtracked to be a cause for the increase in celiac disease. So the increase in celiac disease is a man-made phenomenon. And celiac disease is characterized by having antibodies, autoantibodies, that is an autoimmune response against the transglutaminase enzyme that lines the intestines. There are also antibodies against that gliadin protein. There's also that those gliadin proteins provoke an increase in intestinal. So the gliadin is modified by the transglutaminase enzyme. It makes it much more harmful, and the gliadin increases intestinal permeability. And you can measure that. You can measure by blood levels of the protein zonulin, the other name zonulin, also called haptoglobin 2. This protein's been known about for many years, but it was Dr. Alessio Fasano, when he was at University of Maryland, now at Harvard, who discovered that zonulin is a marker for increased intestinal permeability. So these levels go up in celiac disease, but they actually go up in anybody who consumes wheat and related grains. It goes up more so in someone with celiac disease, but it goes up in everybody who consumes wheat because of the action of the gliadin protein. Now, people may not show always the overt intestinal symptoms in celiac disease, and there are diseases that are related, such as cerebellar ataxia. Remember this? This is where the cerebellum, the primitive part of your brain responsible for motor control, is killed off by an autoimmune response induced by the gliadin protein. So anti-gliadin antibodies kill off the so-called Purkinje cells in your cerebellum, and you start to stumble. You start to trip over cracks in the sidewalk. You start to lose control over your bowels and your bladder. Average age of onset, 52. And eventually you die. You become so debilitated, you can't comb your hair, you can't wipe yourself in the toilet, you can't even do the most basic self-care needs. You live in a wheelchair, in bed, and you eventually die. You die from wheat, the food that all agencies and dietitians tell us must be a part of your diet. There's also a growing recognition that peripheral neuropathies are caused by the gliadin protein of wheat and related grains. This is a situation where most peripheral neuropathies are caused by long-standing diabetes, type 1 or type 2, but it takes years. So if you said, I've had type 2 diabetes, poorly controlled, the hemoglobin A1C of 11.8% for 15 years, that's the kind of situation that causes peripheral neuropathy. These are typically non-diabetics who have no reason to have a peripheral neuropathy and lose sensation in their legs or lose motor control in their leg, typically in the legs, or sometimes in other organs, such as gastroparesis in the stomach. There can be an autonomic neuropathy also for the internal organs. So that's also a gliadin induced problem. And then dermatitis herpetiformis, which is, despite its odd name, has nothing to do with herpes. It's a skin rash provoked by the gliadin protein. It's a nasty rash. And it's a relative of celiac disease, but expressed on the skin. There's a marked increase in the autoimmune disease, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, very common in people, as are many other autoimmune diseases, but Hashimoto's by far the most common. So there's something different in the celiac situation. It could be the increased intestinal permeability to food and bacterial breakdown products. It could be the heightened inflammatory state. It could be some other factors. There's also a recently discovered phenomenon, came from the Mayo Clinic, called gluten encephalopathy. It's a peculiar rapid dementia. Those of you who had relatives or saw people or neighbors or friends who had dementia, it typically goes on for 7, 8, 10, 12 years, right? And decline gradually. Gluten encephalopathy is a form of dementia where the first sign of cognitive impairment, so forgetting things, right, leaving the stove on, all that stuff, the first episode of cognitive impairment to death is 2 years. It's a very aggressive form. It's not a common form, and it can't be diagnosed before death because it's diagnosed at brain autopsy. Not a happy way to make a diagnosis, right? But we now know the gliadin protein of wheat and related grains is also a cause for a very aggressive form of dementia. Intestinal lymphoma. So people, especially people who have had poorly controlled celiac disease, there are many people who say, I'm not going to be bothered with a stupid diet, and they get intestinal lymphoma, a form of cancer. It's very difficult to manage. And of course, the solution is this incomplete notion of a gluten-free diet. So the gastroenterologist hands you a handout or sends you to the dietitian. They tell you to avoid foods that contain gluten. But that is a very incomplete and unsatisfactory answer. Those who have been following this conversation know that there's a lot of problems among them. They say eat gluten-free foods, which is really dumb because gluten-free foods are made with horrible things. That is gluten-free processed baked foods like baking mixes, bagels, breakfast cereals, breads, rolls, pasta. So they're typically made with tapioca starch, cornstarch, potato starch, and which one am I leaving out? Rice flour. Those are the most common ingredients. Well, those things spike your blood sugar sky high, cause extravagant weight gain, are probably detrimental to the microbiome, and accelerate aging dramatically of joints, joint cartilage, eyes, brain, increase the likelihood of type 2 diabetes. A lot. It causes you to glycate, that is glucose-modify proteins in your body. And that's part of the reason why you age faster on a gluten-free diet. So telling people to eat gluten-free foods, not telling them, but avoid gluten-free processed foods made with those no-no ingredients, is really bad, bad advice. And if gluten-free foods are made with cornstarch, which many are, they're contaminated by the zein protein that looks a lot like the gliadin protein of wheat. So some people with celiac will have their disease reactivated or not respond because they're getting cornstarch contaminated by zein protein in their gluten-free foods. And of course, if you get advice to follow a gluten-free diet, but no advice on strategies to correct your microbiome, which is massively disrupted, right? Because the small bowel is all inflamed. Telling someone to follow a gluten-free diet without advice to take steps to restore order in the intestinal microbiome is a very bad thing to do. But that's what goes on in conventional circles, right? So we know a little bit about the microbiome and celiac disease. And I tell you this only because it helps understand celiac disease before we get to non-celiac disease. So we know that in the small bowel, in celiac disease, there are a lot of stool microbes, E. coli, Bacteroides fragilis, other species of Bacteroides like Vulgatus, Prevotella, which is a very concerning microbe, like Prevotella copri, which may be a colon cancer risk and other cancers, Proteobacteria. Proteobacteria is the phylum, the top designation, also now very confusingly called Pseudomonododa. So Proteobacteria, Pseudomonododa, you will also hear them called Enterobacteriaceae, but these are the stool microbes. These are the E. coli, that you're all familiar with, the Ciprobacters, Campylobacters, Klebsiella. So there's all these stool microbes in the small bowel in somebody who's got celiac disease. And there's fewer healthy species, ones you're familiar with, Bifidobacteria, Lactobacilli, and Streptococcacea. But now let's talk about what we start to talk about, that is not so-called non-celiac gluten sensitivity, a very poor name, by the way, and we'll talk about why. So this is many of the same symptoms as celiac disease, irritable bowel-like abdominal discomfort, bloating, diarrhea, excessive gas, headaches like migraine headaches, a lot of emotional effects, anxiety, depression, mind fog, a fatigue, often in a chronic fatigue-like syndrome, and often accompanied by diffuse muscle aches and joint pain, much like a fibromyalgia syndrome. Skin rashes, a variety of skin rashes, could be seborrhea, could be eczema, could be others. But most people with non-celiac gluten sensitivity, so if they have a biopsy of their small bowel, it doesn't show that loss of villi, the crypt hyperplasia, the lymphocyte proliferation, doesn't show any of that stuff. And they're often transglutaminase antibody negative, but there seems to be a growing appreciation that there are many people without celiac disease by biopsy who do have positive transglutaminase enzymes, but they're biopsy negative. Whoops, yeah. Many of these people have positive anti-gliadin antibodies, though. So non-celiac, but they have antibodies against the gliadin protein. There's a sevenfold increase, 700% increase in potential for autoimmune diseases in this non-celiac situation, a 23-fold increase in what are called anti-nuclear antibodies. That's kind of a broad marker for potential for autoimmune diseases. So if you had rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or polymyalgia rheumatica or Hashimoto's thyroiditis, you would have we say ANA positive. Well, people who have non-celiac gluten sensitivity have 23-fold, 2,300% greater levels of the ANA antibody. And just like celiac, marked increase for Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And get this, so that nasty condition, cerebellar ataxia, so well documented by a group from Sheffield, England, the Haji Vazalu group, they've shown that a type of anti-gliadin antibody associated with cerebral ataxia that people with celiac disease can get, and devastating disease, right? Terrible. You die of it. People with non-celiac gluten sensitivity are even more prone to cerebral ataxia than people with celiac disease. And likewise, peripheral neuropathy, just like celiac disease, and encephalopathy, just like celiac disease. I tell you all this, also increased inflammatory markers, increased zonulin blood levels, representing increased intestinal permeability, and an increase in LPS endotoxemia, meaning entry of gram-negative bacterial breakdown products into the bloodstream that exports the effects of a disruptive microbiome to all parts of the body, causing such effects as weight gain, higher blood pressure, insulin resistance, and all the diseases that come from insulin resistance, right? Coronary disease, hypertension, Alzheimer's, dementia, etc. Now, I tell you all this because for years, many thought that non-celiac gluten sensitivity was nonsense, was fiction. Like they thought that irritable bowel syndrome was a fiction. They used to prescribe antidepressants or anti-anxiety or pills or counseling because they thought you were neurotic and you were just being histrionic and overreacting. And so, but now we know, even though there's no marker specific, so the transglutaminase antibodies is pretty specific for celiac disease, though it also overlaps with this non-celiac condition. We don't have that kind of absolute confident biomarker, but you now see there's a whole landscape, whole catalog of things that go wrong. So if somebody says you don't have celiac disease, you don't have a problem. That is not true. The change, I tell you this, this is very confusing, but I tell you this so that you're protected from bad information. So you guys know there's bad information everywhere. And there's this conversation that a gluten-free diet is destructive to the intestinal microbiome because there are some peculiar things that happen when you go gluten-free. Now, we're not really gluten-free, right? Meaning you're eating gluten-free pizza and gluten-free cupcakes with lots of sugar and you've not taken steps to correct your microbiome, all the things they do wrong, right? In conventional healthcare, when they say follow a gluten-free diet. But if you did do that, there's unhealthy changes. There's proliferation of some of the unhealthy species, like Pseudomonas species. Pseudomonas can be good, and some are good, some are bad. There's also good things that happen. A decrease in Bacteroides and some other unhealthy species, very confusing changes. But if you hear that a celiac diet distorts the microbiome, do this, okay? Because they're talking about the conventional notion of a gluten-free diet, which is not what we do. Why would that happen? Well, that the conventional gluten-free diet that the dietitian gives you or the gastroenterologist tells you about with his little handout, you do lose, I hate to tell you this, but wheat and related grains do have some good things in them. They have prebiotic fibers and related compounds like arabinol, xylitol, and amylose that did nourish microbes. So you lose typically about 3 to 5 grams intake per day from those from grains. There's an increase in refined starches, which has some problems, right? Like cornstarch raises blood sugar. No food raises blood sugar higher than cornstarch. No food, not sugar, not candy bars, not orange juice, nothing raises blood sugar higher than cornstarch. And your gluten-free foods contain a lot of cornstarch. There's no talk, of course, in a standard gluten-free diet about prebiotic fibers or the better named microbiota accessible carbohydrates. That's the whole bunch of different things, polysaccharides, polyphenols, et cetera, that microbes like to eat. And of course, no one's talking about fermented foods. So a lot of holes, a lot of problems. So to say that a gluten-free diet causes unhealthy changes in the microbiome is based on ignorance of what a healthy diet should look like and what they're actually doing when they try to put someone in a gluten-free diet. There's also this growing appreciation. I hope that we, all of us, have had a contribution to increase the awareness that the only problem in wheat and grains is not gluten. There's a whole ton of other things, just like in cigarettes. The only problem is not tar, because tar was the only problem with cigarettes. Low-tar cigarettes would be a cure, and you should be smoking lots of low-tar cigarettes. That, of course, is not true. Same thing here. There are other things in wheat and grains, other proteins like alpha-1 antitrypsin, amylase inhibitors. There's wheat germ agglutinin, a very potent bowel toxin, amylopectin A, which is the carbohydrate that is responsible for extravagant rises in blood sugar, insulin resistance, growth of visceral fat. And so what are we doing that's different Could I have everybody mute your microphones, please? I'm getting a lot of background noise. All right, thank you. So what are we doing? Because we're not doing a standard gluten-free diet, right? We're kind of following a pre-agricultural diet. That's one way to think of our diet, right? Because it was agriculture that made a lot of mistakes. Monoculture crops, wheat and grains, right? Seeds of grasses, processed foods. So we're in effect following a pre-agricultural diet based on meats, organs, hope, right? And foods that are least processed of all, root vegetables, legumes, fruit, plants, right? We try to avoid health disrupting and microbiome disrupting factors, right? Chlorinated drinking water, synthetic food additives like emulsifying agents like carrageenan and polysorbate 80, and preservatives like potassium sorbate or sodium benzoate that are antimicrobials in your GI tract. On and on. So we avoid all the things that disrupt health, disrupt the microbiome. And we're compensating for nutrients that are lacking in modern life, not because of the diet, but because of modern lifestyle habits, like vitamin D because we live indoors, omega-3s because we refuse to eat brains anymore, right? And we can't eat all the fish we want because there's mercury, can't all the shellfish we want because there's cadmium. We don't get enough magnesium because we filter our drinking water, unlike rivers and stream water that you can't drink because it's got sewage and farm runoff. Iodine, because most of us are not coastal and don't eat seaweed and lots of seafood. So we have to get iodine from some source. And we're entertaining this conversation about what about things that come from organs like collagen and hyaluronic acid and phosphatidylserine. So lack of those causes acceleration of skin aging, joint breakdown, dementia, hypertension, coronary disease, and other conditions. Should we be adding back these things? It could, well, we can't eat brain, right? Because farmers have kind of destroyed that market because they were feeding brains to their livestock. And it caused prion disease, like mad cow disease. So we can't do that. But in a wild world, that's what we do. And we would gnaw on bones and bone marrow and heart and tongue and pancreas and kidneys and liver, as well as the meat. And we would get plenty of collagen and hyaluronic acid and phosphatidylserine. But we're not doing those things, right? So these are things to start thinking about. Should we do these things? So remember, we don't treat things around here. We don't say treat thinning skin with collagen. Instead, we say, let's provide the collagen you should have been getting, whose need is programmed into your genetic code, right? A little different, right? We're not treating things. We're addressing human need based on adaptation over millions of years. And of course, we enjoy lots of fermented foods because they, not so much because they colonize the GI tract, but because they mold species composition of the GI tract. Remember that? So if you get, let's say, Lactobacillus plantarum and Pediococcus pentosaceus and some Leuconostoc mesenteritis from your fermented sauerkraut, they don't take up residence in your GI tract for more than a few days tops, but they somehow cultivate the setting for other healthy microbes. Not quite sure how that works. No one does, but it works. So lots and lots of fermented foods. And of course, the so-called microbiota accessible carbohydrates, prebiotic fibers, polysaccharides, such as in mushrooms, root vegetables, onions, shallots, garlic, legumes, root vegetables, inulin powder, galacto-oligosaccharides in beans, polysaccharides, polyphenols, et cetera. So bottom line, if someone says you don't have celiac, you don't have a problem, that exposes deep ignorance that you don't have to have celiac to have very serious problems with consumption of wheat and grains, but that a gluten-free diet is a woefully inadequate solution to celiac disease as it is to non-celiac gluten sensitivity. Okay. Share.